listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, I want to introduce the guys. Actually, I want to introduce half the guys because we're missing the other half, but we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello there.
Martin and Bobby are both not here.
Hello.
Hello, then.
We're not here, are we?
And today we have a really special guest. We have Andrew Sheps with us.
Hi there. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
He is one of the mixers of the Red Hot Chili Peppers' new album, Stadium Arcadium, and it's a great album. So we're going to be talking to him about that. But before we start talking about that, I want to bring up a really strange phenomenon. Right here in this room, there are actually more former Stevie Wonder techs than people who've never worked for Stevie Wonder before.
Now that's scary.
Well, that actually follows the LA demographic, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think it does.
That's right. Is there anybody who hasn't worked for Stevie Wonder in LA?
Would they please raise their hand.
But Rob, you've been with him for, well, ever.
I've been with him since 85.
And
the first tour I did was end of 85, early 86.
And Andrew, you were with Stevie
on I believe it was in 92. It was a Natural Wonder tour. It was a European tour.
And then I came in right after you left, and I spent about 4 years working with him, surviving the Stevie Wonder tour experience. I don't know about you guys, but one thing I really liked about Stevie Wonder's tour was that it really exposed me to a huge MIDI rig. I mean, before I had done some big MIDI rigs.
Oh, yeah, that it did.
Yeah.
But that was one of those gigs where you were just like, you were exposed to pretty much MIDI in every way, flavor, shape, form.
Well, the first tour I did with him, there wasn't actually a big MIDI rig. There were like a zillion single devices in individual anvil cases that I had to stack up and wire for every show. Nothing was in big racks. So every day of a show, the rig had to be assembled from scratch and then torn down afterwards.
Man.
So in 86, I think we actually built the first big rigs, or, yeah, 86, 87.
Andrew, did you build the rig that you used on the Natural Wonder Tour, or was it already built when you got
there? It was sort of half built. I mean, you know, the guy I took over from said, oh, yeah, it's built. And then you show up and it's not built.
Right.
It was kind of built. But the other thing, I mean, I remember is there were boxes showing up every show. Stuff would show up and it was always three of them because they're two keyboard players and Stevie. And so, you know, you're at the second show on the tour and all of a sudden everybody gets a sound canvas.
Right.
And they're half rack and they didn't get the rack kit. So you duct tape those to the side of the rack. So stuff was showing up constantly. So by the time we finished, the rig was probably twice as big as when we started, and keyboards leaning up against it and on top of it.
Yeah, there was never a permanent rig. It would just change because as technology would change, Stevie was using the stuff, and then if you wanted to recreate the stuff live in concert, we'd have to have the same gear. And it didn't matter if it was a sound canvas or a Synclavier. There had to be a few of them.
Yeah.
In 92, when I started the gig, each keyboard player had two 24-space racks. And then Stevie had two 24-space racks plus the wave frame that he had, and then another single rack full of units. I mean, basically you
Well, that single rack came later when the double rack got full. The double rack was called the Rack of Doom.
That's right, the Rack of Doom.
And the Rack of Doom always had the coolest stuff in it.
Yeah, that's right.
But then there was not enough room in the Rack of Doom. I mean, the Rack of Doom could have been three stories tall and we would have filled it. There was, you know, no limit to the amount of gear we'd drag on a tour.
I went through one rewire on that when we took out the DMP 11s.
I was glad you did because I didn't have to.
And then we put in when I say we, it was me and the other keyboard tech, Kevin McCourt. And then we put in the O1Ws on sliding trays, and that was definitely experience, you know, going through all that. And we also used that. What was that MIDI patcher? That
the Synapse.
Oh, the Jal Cooper?
No, we had one where it was like 15 in and 21 out or something. It might
no,
have been
I think that was 16 in, 20 out. The Synapse.
Yeah.
I still use one.
And
in
you
my
could
studio.
Chain them together.
Yes,
yeah.
And they were chained together. That was one big MIDI setup.
You know what? That is still one of the best patch bays if you do a lot of SysX stuff in a studio.
Yeah, that's and one of the stupidest things to program ever.
It's
got what? It's got 2 8-segment LEDs and that's it.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And it does a lot.
Yeah, especially trying to do SysX commands on you know, 2 LEDs was just really a challenge. The other thing that I remember too was for as big as that system was, it was pretty bulletproof. We never really had too many problems except when we were in Singapore that one time and the wayframe got fried.
Yeah, we had different problems in different parts of the world because of climate. That's what happened in Brunei and Singapore was the climate.
I thought it was
basically rained inside the wayframe and it shorted out.
Well, I always thought it was the 220 volts that they sent through that thing that fried the
Well, that was something always that puzzled me about the way the stage was set up is that they would have U.S. plug boards with 220 in them.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than have European plugs with the 220 and right. U.S. with the 110, right. they just, like, whatever, everybody had a U.S. plug, and then you had to know which rack got the 220 and which mm-hmm. got the 110. And that popped some stuff on the tour I was on, too.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thing.
Yeah, it's not good.
The other thing that I remember is that since I set up Stevie's Rack of Doom and I set up the Waveframe, I was glad I got the air conditioner when we were doing outside gigs.
Well, when we lost enough equipment due to heat problems and they finally brought an air conditioner on tour, yeah, that was the good place to be because we could be in a sweltering, you know, venue in Indonesia where it's 110 degrees. But if you happen to be in the air conditioned tent with the gear that needed to be cool, you
were
cool.
I mean, I left the Stevie Wonder tour to do a Michael Jackson tour and it was the same thing. I was looking after synclavs. And so I had a tent big enough for synclavs and a hammock and a bunch of beers and about four people. And it was full all the time.
That's the party tent.
The road stories. Well, I feel a really good sense of camaraderie with you guys.
It's just like old times.
And Scott couldn't care less.
What?
I know, Scott's sitting over there going, what? Well, anyhow, Andrew, I just want to thank you for joining us today. And let's talk a little bit about your last project that you did, mixing the Chili Peppers. First of all, I want to tell you that I think the record is just great. And I don't mean to, you know, kiss your butt or anything like that. but you know, one thing that I really liked about it, it's a very open sound. It doesn't sound collapsed and you get so many of the new records that are just, you can just tell they just take that bus compressor and just squeeze the bejeebies out of it, you know, and suck out all the life. And the other thing that I thought was really cool was just some of your really cool, you know, chances that you took with panning your guitars, you know, hard left or hard right and all those kind of things. What kind of inspired you to when you started taking on this mix?
Well, a lot of the panning stuff, I guess to work backwards, is actually dictated by what was on the song. A lot of the overdubs are done by John Frusciante, the guitar player. He does a lot of processing, a lot of treatments to things using modular synths or guitar pedals or whatever it is. And he builds an arrangement of all of this stuff. And it's pretty specific. I mean, sometimes I would build up a mix and have things panned a certain way. And his first comment would be, okay, well, that thing you got on the right has to be on the left because it goes with this other thing on the left. So the panning a lot of times was really set by the tracks, and it was really built to be a very stereo-wide record. So a lot of times that wasn't even my choice necessarily, but I loved being able to do it. I mean, there's songs that start with a single acoustic guitar, and that guitar is hard right because why shouldn't it be? Because when other things come in, they join in the middle, and all of a sudden your stereo field really grows as the song goes and things like that.
Yeah, you're talking about Snow, right? Because that's a brilliant song.
Yeah, Snow does that. Slow Cheetah does it. There are a few songs.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. I really like – it gives a lot of space for everything to be heard. That's the thing mm-hmm. I really liked about it because you have your guitars panned hard right, and then another one will come in hard left, and the bass and come in, and the drums, and it just has a lot of space, and mm-hmm. I just think that's brilliant.
And there was also a lot of cheating things slightly out of the center. Like there are a lot of times where with the bass there'll be a few tracks of bass with DI and then maybe a distorted track or things like that. And the tracks with more top end, I would cheat out of the center to leave room for the snare drum and the vocal and things like that. So the low end's in the middle, but use a little more of the field to get it out of the way of other stuff.
Did you find any particular challenges on any of the tracks? Anything that you just struggled with?
Well, I mean, the first thing about the whole album, both for Ryan, who mixed the other half of the record, and myself, is that it was cut completely on analog tape and stayed on analog tape. It wasn't put into the computer and then put back or anything. So we're mixing off of tape with almost nothing. I mean, if anything was coming out of Pro Tools, it might have been some percussion overdubs or things like that that didn't fit and we would have needed a third machine. But basically, we're mixing off of tape. So we had the challenge that a lot of people don't remember at all, of having track 12 on The Slave has six different things on it. And this thing in the first half of the verse, something else in the second half of the verse, and you have to mult that out on the console, do mute automation so you can pan them differently and treat them differently. So just re-remembering how to do that was a big deal. It took like about a week to really get into it.
What tape machines and consoles did you use?
Well. Two Studer 800 tape machines.
Yep.
The old workhorses. And
15 or 30 amps?
At 30. 30, no noise. At plus 3, which was a decision made during tracking. A little low for me. I mean, I would have liked to see him hit the tape a little bit harder on some of the tracks, only because dynamically there was so much going on.
Right.
But in general, it worked out great. It gave tons of headroom. Mm-hmm. And then it was mixed on a Neve 8068 console, a 72 input that I rented from Classic, which is a great board. It's the 40 input side that they track the album through.
Right.
And then it has a 32 input brother, I guess, that we brought over and tied the two consoles together.
Wow.
What other outboard gear did you use?
Well, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was an old school sort of record, so it was a lot of old school stuff with some outboard Neve compressors, Pultex, APIs. Used a lot of API EQ on guitars, as well as the 525 compressors, which I was loving. 33609 on the bass quite often. 1176s, lots of those. That's sort of my go-to vocal compressor, as well as the drum crush compressor, you know, ultra compressed that you bring back in with the original tracks. Just a lot of old stuff.
Yeah, that's so funny because I didn't know that you did it all on tape, and I was going to say it has a very classic sound, and now I know why. Because it lets the music speak. The songs become the focus and not the gee whiz, you know, look at what I can do.
Yeah, I mean, I love digital too. I mean, I work in Pro Tools all the time, and I'm not a, you know, analog is always better than digital guy. But one interesting thing is when the album comes out on vinyl, it'll be a true AAA recording because it's 2-inch tape through a Neve to 1/2-inch tape, and they're going to cut the vinyl directly off the 1/2-inch. So it'll be one of the few things in years that has zero digital conversions by the time you hear it. So I'm actually really curious to hear the vinyl and see how different it is from the CD. I mean, obviously, the level's going to be controlled a little bit on some stuff, but it should be really interesting.
Now, how different is your mix when you went into mastering? Sometimes you talk to some mixers and some engineers, and they go into the mastering suite, and they really kind of tweak the bejeebies out of the mix. What about on this one? Did you?
Not a whole lot. I mean, there was definitely time spent making sure that Ryan's mixes and my mixes matched up. So there were some things done just to do that, only because as you went through the record, I mean, our styles are different. And, you know, as you listen to the record more, I mean, I hear differences between our mixing styles that on first listen you don't notice, which is good because the last thing you want to do is notice the mixes
right. The
first time through. But so there was some time spent on that just because sometimes one of my mixes following his, something would sound different. But not a whole lot, actually. I mean, the mastering process, you know, you always worry about it as a mixer and wonder how much is it going to change and is it going to be good, because you don't get a whole lot of time to really listen. And it was great. It just, stuff got a little louder and the imaging got a little more defined and off it went.
Some of the little, you know, fun little moments, like in Danny, California, the little flange effect before the guitar solo. Who makes those decisions? Was that
Well, that was actually – that one came out of something that John had wanted to do, where they actually had Eddie Kramer come into the studio and they had 3 half-inch machines and they tape phased the mix. And they just spent all day doing it. They actually did it with Ryan. I wasn't there that day. And they spent all day just phasing the mix and like, oh, that piece is great and that piece is great. And their versions, as we were working on the song, that had a lot more of it. And we just decided at the end that better to have this one huge blast of it going into the guitar solo than to have little bits of it everywhere to sort of give it away. So I just had a tiny little half-inch piece of the mix bean flange that I had to cut in, you know, before I sent it off to mastering. So I was always printing the mix without that. I mean, I didn't have it. And then we just cut it in.
That is so amazing that they would take that kind of time to do it that way.
Well, this whole album was that. I mean, there was never a question of, well, how much time is it going to take? It's just, what do we want to do? So you spend as much time as it takes to get it the way you want it, which is great. And it doesn't happen a lot. You know, it's a luxurious thing.
On the average, how long did it take to mix a song?
Average is probably 3 days, maybe four. I mean, because it's also – it's a long approval process because there are a lot of guys involved.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff going on in – I mean, some of the songs – most of the songs, the base of them is incredibly simple. It's just those guys playing their instruments and you're done. But the overdubs, there's a lot going on and there's a big arrangement of them. So sometimes it could take a whole day just making sure you'd found all the pieces and you could really hear them and deciding on the panning on some things and stuff like that. So – I mean, there were a couple songs that got done in a day and a half, and a couple that took 5 days, 6 days. So it depended, but it was long.
What kind of speakers did you end up using?
I've got my Tannoy SRM-10Bs, the pre-Super Gold. So, and I love those speakers, and I've tried tons of other ones, and I just go back to those. So I've got those on an old Crown power amp, DC-300, and that's it.
What do you like about those monitors?
The thing that and powered monitors are a different thing, but for passive monitors, the thing that usually is the defining sound of the speaker is the crossover point. As you go from the woofer to the tweeter, what happens in the mid-range? And like NS10s have a very harsh pushed forward mid-range, which can be great. I mean, you can work with it, but these speakers have you can't find the crossover point. There's no particular frequency where there's something weird going on. They've just done an amazing job getting that right in the crossover. And that's why with the SGMs, which were the next model, they're the Mastering Lab crossovers, and Manly now makes crossovers and new enclosures, and it's all to try to get back to that incredibly smooth response as you go between the two drivers. And they get really loud and they have tons of low end. So they have more low end than the mains in most studios.
But then how do you find that it translates? When you get the low end, you like it, it feels good.
It's perfect. What happened when I was mixing on NS10s mostly is I would find there would be boomy things in the low mids that I wouldn't know about. And you go get in a car and car stereos really accentuate that and it would just obliterate the song and you wouldn't have any idea. So then you have to go back into the studio and try to fix something you can't really hear, whereas on the Tannoys I hear everything. And you know, it's not like I catch everything the first time around, but if someone listens and says, I don't know, I think this is a little bit like this, when I go back with that new perspective, I can always hear it. I'm never guessing at what I'm doing.
Right.
From what I understand, you were involved with tracking some of the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that. What kind of mics did you use, and how did that go?
Well, the thing with Anthony is he's used the same mic for the last, I mean, I don't know how many records. It's a Shure SM7, which is, you know, it's a broadcast mic, basically. Is it a super cardioid? I think it's tighter than a straight cardioid.
Yeah, and probably super cardioid.
And it's a reasonably large diaphragm. And we tried all kinds of mics on them. We tried a 251, we tried a 47, a C12, and they all sound great because they're amazing microphones. But the SM7 is what sounds like Anthony. So that was our mic. And then the vocal chain, I mean, it's the same vocal chain I use on kind of anybody I record when I can, is a 1073 into an 1176, just at 4:1, just a little bit of compression for their ears, really. And that's it. That's the chain.
Yeah, because the vocal is a very well, it's definitely his sound, but it's also a very honest sound. You know, it just captures his performance, which lends to the whole classic sound of the whole thing in the first place.
Well, I think it's a lot to do with the way we recorded things, and then also the way we mix things is we didn't process a lot. I mean, there's a lot of tracks that were maybe a microphone in front of an amp that went straight to tape with no compression, and then in the mix it came up on the console, got panned with no EQ and no compression, and that's what's in the mix, and the mix isn't compressed. I mean, half my mixes, I've got nothing on the bus. There's no compression.
Nice.
So you let the tape do its job, and then, you know, in mastering, obviously, it gets limited a little bit.
On some of the songs where you have some of that vocal stuff happening that's a little subtle, like the low vocals, and it's kind of spread out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do anything special to kind of get that little, it sounded like a little high-end something up there, just to...
Well, some of that's just the top-end EQ on the Neve, and also a lot of the backgrounds are John's vocals, and he just has that quality to his voice. I mean, he has an incredible voice, and it has a unique sound to it. So he's actually easy to hear in a track, just the sound of his voice. So just EQ, really.
What kind of reverbs did you get into at all, or what did you play with?
Let me think. There's not a whole lot of reverb on there. I mean, there's I used a lot of slap, actually, with that old Yamaha bizarre box. I think it's like an E1000. There's some – it's like a tabletop guitar analog delay line thing.
Right.
So there's a lot of that. I did use some of the convolution reverbs. So I used the Waves IR1 with impulses of rooms because there were a couple times where I really wanted some cavernous stuff going on. Used 250 on a couple of songs, the MT250, you know, the R2-D2. And there were a couple instances where I actually used Everb because that's the reverb that's the easiest to hear. So when you're trying to actually do something with a reverb, it's grainy and in your face and you really hear it. So I actually made some reverb effects using Deverb and things like that. But for the most part, it's just slap and like some very subtle either plate or small room stuff.
It's funny you say Deverb because I always, when I'm going to do any kind of backwards reverb effect, I always end up using Deverb for it because it just, you really hear it. It's just
yeah, everything
so
else
present.
Is a little too good.
Yeah, everything else is too smooth and too transparent.
Now, how did you get the signal in and out of Pro Tools to use that Deverb? Did you use it as an aux bus and just have a...
Yeah, just on an aux.
So you had a Pro Tools system set up and you auxed out of the console, you went into an aux, did your processing and came right back in.
Brought it up on a couple of faders, yeah.
So Pro Tools was like a giant effects unit at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it had nothing else to do, so it was getting bored. I mean, literally, this album had just about no Pro Tools to it, which is, it was really refreshing in a way. I mean, I love Pro Tools. I spend my life working on it, but it was great to sit there with the tape machine remote. I got my Microlinx out, you know,
and
it's sitting on the console and it worked like a champ, which was great.
Was it an edict that was, you know, passed down that like, we're going to do it this way? Or did
I mean, it was a decision at the very beginning to try and make a, not necessarily an old school record, but to adhere to kind of that process. And a lot of that process is not just the gear you use, but it's also the concept as you work. I mean, on tape, you have to make a decision. There are no playlists. So if you like that solo, but you think you can do better, you either find another track or you go over it. And that's it. And if you never do better, well, you have to get something that you're going to be cool with. So, it's really, really good. And also because you're not going to be editing drums or anything like that, you play the song until you get it. You know, and you might edit between some takes, but there's a lot of on-the-spot decision-making, which I think really makes people step up. You know, I mean, these guys play great all the time anyway, but I think it's a good lesson for any musician to not get to the point where you say, yeah, we probably have everything we need, to say what I'm hearing right now is either it or it isn't. And that's it. And that ended up, I think, being a great offshoot of the sort of analog recording philosophy of doing it all on tape.
You know, it keeps everything in the moment. You know, and when you listen to the songs, it sounds like it's in the moment.
Yeah, you'll never say, well, we'll come back later and hear what we have.
So basically you were capturing the performance rather than manufacturing the performance.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, job well done. Both you and Ryan. It's a great album, and it's just really refreshing to hear something that that was mixed and just lets, you know, the mix didn't get in the way and it lets the music speak for itself, and I think that's really great. Especially today with all the gizmos and the plugins and all the digital editing and everything. It's just nice to hear a really good record.
I'm glad it comes across that way because it was definitely the goal.
All right, well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're actually going to do a little mixing 101, and we're going to give you guys some tips on how to start a mix. All right, we'll see you on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before we move on, just goes to show you that all the good stuff happens on the break. We were talking with Andrew, and he was bringing up some really good things about how he kept track of all 44 tracks that he had with the two machines slaved together. Why don't you Explain a little bit on how that all worked.
Well, we were just talking about how, for the first time in years, I had to do a lot of mute automation on the console, either to take care of noise between things or multing things out when you have multiple stuff on one track. And we had safeties of all the analog tapes in Pro Tools, and I would just slave this session. And of course, it's not playing back to anywhere, but I have pictures of what's on tape. So I'd be doing mute automation and looking at the screen and seeing where all the background vocals came in and where they left. And it probably saved me 4 or 5 hours per song, at least.
It's like being able to look over at the 2-inch tape machine and actually see waveforms on the tape.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. It was perfect.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I think that, what a brilliant solution there. So a little bit of old, a little bit of new, and you keep going on.
Yeah.
Scott, did you want to...
No, I was just, you know, and during the break we were talking that upon listening to all the things you were describing, how many of the things that you were doing in music are incredibly applicable to sound design and post-production and the way we mix and how reverbs cut through the mix or to create a little bit of grunge with a different kind of processor, adding it back to an original sound to make it bite more. You know, in film and stuff that I'm dealing with so many tracks and so much thickness between dialogue, music, and effects that we're always trying to compete to how we can have certain sounds cut through at different times. So I'm a fan. I mean, I use music myself as an inspiration to see how I can better create the designs that we do and the mixes that we do in the film business. So I'm just sitting here fascinated.
You know, one thing that that this really reminds me of is back in the old days meaning before all the DAWs, I did a mix, my very first mix on a film stage, and seeing all the mag machines that they would have all linked together in the recorder's room, all synced together, all coming up on the desk, and with the cue sheets that they would have all by hand, and just that whole juggling act, that was, talk about a feat in synchronization.
Well, just hearing those mag machines like slow down to zero and then reverse direction.
Oh, yes.
Sounded like the space shuttle taking off.
Let me ask you, Scott, as long as we're talking about, you know, mag machines and film, do you think the sound quality of those old mag machines, or is it better than what you get off the digital workstations now, or?
Different. A lot of times I'm dealing with about 300 tracks, and if I do 300 tracks of analog, the noise floor is just huge.
Yeah. You got to be flipping the phase on things just to try and cut it down.
And then just trying to get things to punch and keep track of it. And also, like you were talking about visual cue sheets, you're trying to remember where stuff is and you've got tape everywhere, you know. I really miss tape compression. I mean, there's a certain sound that the tape brings and I definitely miss that. But I do love the clarity and certain kinds of bite that digital sometimes can bring. You know, I can't say one's better than the other. They're just very different. You know, with one thing, you lose something else, but you try to find something in the middle.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing you lose is the ping pong or pool table games that you used to be able to play in between wheel changes.
No, we still got those. Now, a lot of times I'm dragging about 30 Pro Tool systems. It takes a while to put different drives in, open the sessions, 6971, you know, compatibility issues. It still takes some time.
I remember I was working over at Disney. I think it was on Stage C. It was like one of the last times I ever saw mag in a film mix. And I always look forward to those reel changes because the recorders had to go and change all the mags on all the different machines. And so you were guaranteed at least a 10-15 minute break, you know, while that all takes place.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On all films, most films now are still having a mag copy of the master. So when we do a digital copy, we're also laying down a mag copy at the same time for archival purposes. Because one of the things when they, you know, send them to the salt mines or, you know, the dry mines to archive them, the problem with digital is the formats keep changing. So, you know, something you did 5 years ago, you may not be able to play it back. And, you know, whether it's MMRs, what formats? What was before that? Was it a Kai? Remember the Kai dubbers?
Oh, yeah.
They were still out there, and everyone's used different things. And for a studio to find out that after only 5-6 years, they actually can't play back their masters, that, you know, that scares them. So actually right now, mag is still the de facto archival format.
Well, that makes sense because, you know, how many MO – I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of MO masters out there, but now MO is, you know, you don't find a new MO drive.
Well, like even the MMRs, which are really common, you know, they're using narrow 9 gigs. You know, you can't get them anymore. I mean, you can't get the 9 gigs, you can't get the narrows. And now everybody's going, you know, FireWire at least, 500 gig drives, you know. Where are you going to find 9 gigs again?
I've actually worked with some artists in archiving their masters, and if they are going to archive a digital master these days, they tend to also archive a machine that can play them.
Yeah.
And that becomes necessary. If you have, you know, even from the early days of digital tape, if you have 3M32 track, 1-inch digital master tapes, you better have a machine that can play them too, because if you don't, nobody else does.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Well, what about mag? I mean, no one's making new mag machines, so.
But, yeah, but they're still around, and I think that, you know,
they were built like
tanks. I mean, yeah, you know, and they just put them in the in these mines, in these caves that have absolutely no humidity, and they just store them there. And you know, what you really want to do is create a company that every 5 years takes everybody's libraries and assets and keeps turning around to the latest greatest. I mean, we're on the verge of that right now between DVD and all the different new formats, whether it's HD DVD, and Blu-ray. So, you know, we're right now yet doing another format change. I mean, remember the jazz drives and zip drives and jets? And
I think we all still have all of them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. For exactly that reason. And I've got my Synclav optical drives that I still have to get stuff off of every once in a while.
And the exabyte, the little exabyte waveframe drives. And, you know.
What did you archive the album? The stadium archiving?
Yeah, I mean, we're just safety in the analog, so there'll be copies of the analog tapes on other analog tapes. And because we'd already made safeties onto Pro Tools, I mean, we have those as well. But the main archives is the tape.
What did you use on Pro Tools? Just actually curiosity for A to Ds. Did you use the 192s or something else?
Yeah, I mean, there were some DB technology, the gold channels around at certain times, but I love the 192s. To me, they sound like what goes in. Other converters have great sound to them, but I'm a huge fan of the 192s. So for me, that's all I used.
Well, we're going to segue from that to starting a segment right now that I'm going to call Mixing 101. And since we have Andrew here and Scott and Rob, one thing that I want to do is give people some really helpful tips on how they can mix their own music. And the first thing I want to cover is just the beginning. How do you start a mix? You know, some people I've talked to, they get really intimidated by just the whole mixing process, you know, whether it's post-production and working in broadcast where you get, you know, maybe 24 channels of all kinds of stuff, or you're working in music where you can have 56, you know, 106 channels. Where do you guys start your mix? Like when you started mixing this album, where did you start?
Well, the first thing I think that's got to happen before you can decide where you're going to start is you've got to get familiar with the material and know what it is you're mixing, what the whole picture is. So it was fortunate for me because I tracked, I mean, all the vocals on every song that Anthony did pretty much. So I knew every song and I knew every track on every song. So I didn't have to spend a whole lot of time just pulling up tracks to see what was there. Another good thing for that is if people are working in Pro Tools, every song comes with a mix. It always comes with whatever balance they had up last, and usually they've printed a mix into the session. So the first thing is to hear what it is you're mixing and get some idea of what's important and what isn't. For music mixing, I mean, it's almost a cliche at this point, but probably I'll start with a kick drum, you know, as the first instrument I need to bring up, only because on what I mix, which is mostly rock stuff, it's the foundation of the motor of the song on just about every song you mix. So that's got to be right. And then you build up the drums around that. But I never really work with just things soloed for very long. I kind of get stuff close, and then I try to get to the point where I get a rough balance on the console that works all the way through the song. And then I can refine things from there. But if I can't get the song to sort of play start to finish without turning on the automation, then there's something wrong. I've got something too loud, or, I mean, generally the arrangement should play itself. So I kind of went past which ended up somewhere else.
No, but that's actually that's really good because you know that's a pretty obvious point is just to know your material right off the bat. Okay, now you know your material. Do you start with faders at Unity? Do you go with a temp mix? And it sounds like, you know, you were saying you start with your bass drum and you kind of build around that. I actually know a mixer who totally unconventional, but he always started with his guitars because he was so into the guitar tone and then kind of mixed around that, which I thought was a little weird, but you know, you hear his mixes and it's like, wow, sounds really good.
Yeah. I mean, if it works, it works. It's, I mean, there's always, I think Ryan actually had a piece of tape on the console to, because it's just something always to keep track of is who's driving the bus. Yeah. And there's – it could be 12 things. It could be one thing. But there's always something that's really important about the song. I mean, obviously, in vocal rock stuff, the vocal's always important and the melody is always important. But you've got to know what's driving it. And sometimes you'll assume it's the guitars, but it may not be. I mean, a perfect example on Stadium Arcadium is Torture Me, where the guitars are a massive wall. But the bass, melodically, is really what sort of drives the song on. And when you mix the song based on the guitars there, I think it just – it doesn't drive as hard as if you really keep the bass in mind, as opposed to treating the bass just for low end or something like that. So, I mean, it definitely can change song to song, but it's really important to know what's important and make sure that is audible. It doesn't have to sound good, but you got to be able to hear it.
Okay, so our first point is we got to find out what drives the song, whether it's the bass, guitar, whatever. We got to know what drives the song. One question I want to ask you, Scott, when you're sitting in on the mixes, how do they approach 300 tracks of effects to go in a film mix?
You know, it's fascinating because exactly what you said is almost exactly the same way it is in post, and that is you try to find what's driving the scene. Is it dialogue? Is it a music moment? Is it a giant, you know, battle with sound effects that are happening? So you find out in any given moment what is driving that scene and then build around it. The only thing I do, though, is when I mix, I actually subtract mix. What I'll do is I'll put the biggest sound up first, the sound that I want the clearest, whether it's dialogue, whether it's music or effects, and then I'll start adding sounds quieter, backwards into it. And at that point, I can then find out what do we want to keep, what do we want to lose for clarity, what doesn't matter, what gets masked. So as I'm bringing something up and I say, wow, you know what, I can't even hear it. It doesn't matter. It's now gone. So, you know, a lot of times when I'm dealing with so many tracks, the question is, you know, what do you need to hear at any given moment? So you take slices of the scene, and it keeps changing based on how the scene is shaping up. Because I might be hitting music at the beginning, an actress or something, dialogue, and then we go into a giant battle of some sort. So we're constantly moving and weaving around those three elements. But usually I try to take the first thing I start with is what's the most important at that point of the project.
You know, that's a good point. What do you need to hear? Because
you can't hear everything.
Yeah, you can't hear everything. Actually, when I mix for TV, I do a lot of reality TV. And so I start with the dialogue, which would be the equivalent of the kick drum, because you got to hear the words. Mm-hmm. You know, as a producer always told me, hey, you got to hear the words. He didn't care about anything else. He just wanted to hear the words.
No, absolutely. And it's just as important in music, too. And, I mean, the Chili Peppers record isn't a good example of this because it's all very well laid out and thought out. But there is a lot of stuff I'll mix where you just have to get rid of stuff. I mean, just like you're saying, there are things that will be in there, and they might be the coolest thing ever. But if it's in the way of what's important, you've got to get rid of it and slim down the arrangement and make the arrangement work for what there is. And also, as an engineer, you can't have an ego about it. You can't, like, man, check my phaser out, you know. But if it's distracting from the song, then you're not doing it a service.
A lot of that comes back to that albums, like when a band makes an album, one of the things that seems to have gotten lost over time is that the very most important part of that production process is the rehearsals before they even start to record. Because you can eliminate a lot of mixing nightmares by figuring things out in rehearsal before you even track the thing.
Yeah.
And that's sort of gotten lost because the disc recording systems make it way too easy to just say, well, let's record it now and fix it later.
Yeah, well, and also everybody's demos sound great. You know, they're recording on the same stuff anyone else is. So it's real easy to get stuck on something you recorded the first day you wrote the song, and now you go play it live, and the song's a million times better, but the drums sound so good on that version, we'll keep them. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a bad, bad trap to fall into.
It's funny when you're talking about ego, too, because as a mixer, especially if you're mixing for a client, you're not mixing your own stuff, you got to remember that you're mixing for them. And
absolutely.
And I'll never forget, the best piece of advice I ever got was I was working with a gentleman who said, you always try what the client wants. And you let them come to the conclusion that they were wrong. Because if you mix something and you argue with them, when they see the show on TV 2 years later, they're just going to hate you every time that moment comes
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. So. There are a million right ways to do it. And I think the core of what you just said is prove them wrong. You know, if you really feel like, oh, it's going to destroy it, well, they'll know if it's gotten destroyed.
Right. That is, you know, it's a double-edged sword now with the new technology. Because on one hand, the new technology enables you to try a lot of different ideas and mixes and experiment to see what might come out that's great. On the other hand, it might take a lot of time and a lot of experimentation and –
But I think the other thing is, instead of sort of half realizing something, you go all the way with it and then you have to make a decision about it. That's either the way it's going to be or not. I mean, the trap you can fall into there is that you'll print 700 different versions of the mix and you'll get to mastering and realize no one's even decided which the mix is.
Right.
Which, you know, as the mixer, you always put a star next to the one you like. That's and then they get to mastering, and if nobody knows, they master the one with the star
on it. That's right. Yeah, you want that one right there with the star. Okay, so we're starting the mix, and we've defined what drives the song, and then we define what do we need to hear. Where do you guys go next? Do you work on your rhythm, and then you mix the bass in, and then you fold the guitars into that? And how do you know when and where to start putting a little bit of the ear candy? Is it just what you feel, or is it what the song dictates? I mean, let's take it back to the beginning and just walk us through some of this stuff.
It's kind of hard to know because it's also, I mean, you evolve as a mixer the longer you do it. I remember years ago when I would mix, it was all, I would have little checklists in my head like, hey, have I done this yet? Or I better do this next. And it's very hard to do that. Whereas now my brain just sort of will focus over here and then focus over there and I'll keep switching. I try to leave everything up 90% of the time when I'm mixing. And then if I need to solo something to hear what's going on, I'll do that. But I don't like building the mix up a few things at a time because you'll maybe start focusing somewhere you shouldn't because you'll bring in all the guitars, but you've spent so long listening to just the drums and the bass that you might have missed the fact that, well, there's something in the guitars that makes what you just did to the bass irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So I try to keep everything and then things will just catch my ear. And sometimes you just let the mix loop. You know, even with the microlinks, it was one of the great things. Even though it's on tape, you get your rewind time, but then you just let the mix loop, and if something bugs you three times in a row, you got to fix it.
Do you have a target that visually or in your mind you can kind of see, kind of hear of like how you think this thing is going to pull together, and are you aiming for that target? Or are you going on a journey and kind of letting the mix come to you and you know when you've arrived?
It's a really bizarre combination of both. I mean, I think you always feel as though you're following the mix. Like it's already finished and you have to find it. But at the same time, it's always dictating itself to you. I mean, as you bring up the tracks and get the arrangement together and sort of get what I was talking about before, just the static balance that works, it starts to play itself. And then all you're doing is sort of fixing what isn't quite working about that. So it's almost like the mix is always there and I just keep fixing all this stuff. It's like the carving the statue of an elephant of a block of granite. You just get rid of everything that doesn't look like an elephant.
Yeah.
And I think in my own mind that's how I feel I'm doing the mix, even though I'm sure it isn't at all. You know, I'm probably driving the mix much more than that by things I'm doing.
Rob, you work with just a really great mixer, Gary, and you get to see him mix every day. When he approaches his mix, not that you have to speak for him, but what do you observe in his mixes? Because first of all, you might want to tell who Gary is.
Yeah, his name's Gary O. Actually, his full name's Gary Adante, but he has many credits under name Gary Olazabal. It's a long story, the change in names. But he engineered and mixed Stevie Wonder songs in the Key of Life and a lot of classic albums for too many stars to mention. He's got a huge track record. And his mixing, it's great that we are partnered together at Noisy Neighbors, because I don't mix. You know, I get married to every part that I put on a song. If I'm writing a song or writing a spot, I get married to every part. I think everything needs to be as loud as it can be. And Andrew used to joke that my mixes ended up looking like a yardstick mix with a smiley face EQ, because I wanted everything at full volume and lots of bass and lots of high sparkle. And it's kind of true. I mean, it's Gary is the one who taught me that faders actually can move in two different directions, because I only ever used to push them up. And that's a beginner mistake. And I've had to mix my own things on occasion just for demos, but it's a real luxury having an engineer in the studio who's such a great mixer. His mixing is really intuitive. He basically works a lot like Andrew was describing, where if it's a piece of pop music, you'd get the kick happening, and then you'd get the drums happening, and then work in the bass and guitars and keyboards around it. And he definitely is of the school of mixing where the whole song should be able to play top to bottom. As long as it was reasonably well recorded, it should be able to play top to bottom without any automation, where everything just finds its spot in the mix. And then you have to go in and tweak it and automate and improve it. But the first thing you do is find a basic balance that can play top to bottom. And then you end up fine-tuning whatever needs the fine-tuning after that. But I know from the analog days when he was making records, basically he would track the stuff and mix it at the same time. So if you pull up one of his old recordings from the 70s or 80s, I guess, on tape, if you just put the console faders at zero, you're basically going to have the mix that made it to the radio, because he used to mix the stuff as he tracked it. And that was
pretty amazing. And it's a great school of engineering that's definitely disappeared. I mean, but it goes back to making decisions and also just limited outboard gear. I mean, they knew, well, if I use the delay on this thing, if I don't record it that way, I don't have a delay anymore, because I'm tying it up. So everything was printed. And
the funny part is, you put Isn't She Lovely or Sir Duke or one of those songs up against something that was released 2 weeks ago, you know, it holds up really well.
Well, I think one of the keys to Gary's mixes, and Andrew, to your mixes
and
too.
And Andrew and Gary are friends, so there could have been some knowledge interchange.
But I think one phrase that would describe your mixes was, there's just a really good sense of level. There's just a really good sense of how loud things should be. And I think in order to be a really good engineer, you really got to have to master that. What do you think about that?
It's definitely true. I mean, I would normally think of my mixes as, well, you could turn stuff up and down and it wouldn't really matter. And, you know, I like to think that they're not that fragile and you can do whatever you want. But then whenever I'm printing mixes and it's, okay, we need to do a vocal up, and you turn the vocals up a dB, it's like, man, they're way too loud. And then you think, oh, well, when we do the vocal down, that'll be fine. And you do vocals down half a dB, and like, God, the vocal's too quiet. And it's not that they're fragile, but it's that the balances really are interacting to the point where a half a dB, which if you take one thing, solo it up, turn it down half a dB, you can't tell. I mean, that's the definition of a decibel. You can't tell if it's less than a dB, but within the context of the mix, it'll really drastically change the balance of who's driving the bus. I mean, it really changes that.
To get a really good sense of level, I've always found that if I mix really low, actually play back low, I can really kind of tell where things are falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that much when you're in the studio?
Yeah, I mean, generally the first few hours I have to work pretty loud, because when you're trying to find out what's going on down in the low end, like between the kick and the bass and the bottom of the guitars, you have to really crank the speakers up to do it. And sometimes you do it because if something hurts, it's too harsh, and to find some EQs. But once sort of the basic mix is together, yeah, on the Neves, they've got monitor pots that have clicks on them. I'd be one click up for days. You know, and only if I thought, man, I really can't tell what's going on with something, I might crank it for a second. But, yeah, it's either really quiet or really loud.
And it also saves your ears from
what? Sorry. That's an oldie but
that's
goodie.
That's a new joke.
Yeah. You like that?
Yeah.
Man, made everyone laugh.
Classic.
Hey, Scott, in the film world, the sense of level is a little bit different because obviously, A, dialogue is driving stuff, but you've got such tremendous headroom and the dynamics in film is just incredible.
Yeah, especially with action films and a lot of the films I do are very design driven, so we tend to be a little loud. And also there's the feeling that louder is better, bigger, you know, shake the room, rock the room. One of the things I also like to do when I mix is take the subs out. Because the subs is really going to be the, you know, e-ticket ride, go out and slap somebody a little bit, knock them around. But a lot of times you really don't know what you have because the sub is really masking an enormous amount of things. As well as when you go in over the same piece, I mean, we could mix a 10-minute piece in 2 days. So 10 minutes is 2 days long to mix. So you're hearing the same piece over and over. And a lot of times you're not sure what you're hearing. Your ears are compressing. And so a lot of times I do like to bring, go into dim, take a listen to what we have. Because when they go out in DVD and the other formats, I mean, a lot of films aren't lasting, what, 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks in the theaters. And then they have the second life in TV, DVD, or video pod. So it's important to see how it's going to translate into another medium. It also depends, because if I've got a director with me, they don't care. A lot of directors just want it to be big. They're making a film. They're making a product for a film environment, and that's the most important thing for them. The other markets, they want it to sound good, but you know they want the yayas going. They're making films in the film world, so they want to keep that. That's important. Also, making sure 3K doesn't kill everybody. You know, that all of a sudden, between the dialogue, the screeching lizards and whatever scraping and all the glass explosions happening and the guns, you know, the 3K buildup can be excruciating and trying to find it where a mix can be effective. You still get the e-ticket right, but you're not getting hurt at the same time.
Will they take a master bus and just notch the 3K
in? No. You can't do that because then all of a sudden you're affecting a lot of other elements within a mix. So no, I'm so against bus manipulation in that way. It's really find out what the offending element is and deal with that.
I got you.
Yeah. Even when you deal with large tracks.
One thing I'll mention, it's slightly off topic in some ways, but it applies
okay.
to
we do that all the time.
Well, both of you, yeah. And I tend to take us in tangents often, but it relates to mixing and it relates to film and to music, and that is, I learned a lesson when we were doing the first Godzilla trailer. There were, it's a scene where eventually Godzilla comes in and his foot comes through the roof of a museum, and then all hell breaks loose. And it was the first big trailer I had scored, and I wrote all kinds of incredible music to happen where Godzilla's foot hit the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guess what? Sound effects won that battle.
Which is us.
That was Scott, actually. It was Scott's people. And I learned a lesson. I learned you're supposed to write your really cool music for right before and right after the footstep because you're not going to hear anything during the footstep because the sound effects have to win. In a film mix, there's so many tracks. What Scott's saying is so true. Something has to win all the time. And if it's a giant effects film, the composer needs to know effects are going to win when something is happening like that. But the same holds true in a song. You know, if I have a really cool synth sound and I want to do a part with it, but I also have a huge snare on the song. Well, we know we're going to need a big snare if it's, you know, any kind of rock or dance music. The snare is going to have to be present. So I now, based on what I learned from the film world, I'm now very conscious of things like making sure the synth part that I come up with is not going to conflict time-wise with a big drum or a big sound of some kind.
It's like guitar players who noodle only when the singer's singing.
Right.
And then you have gaps. In
exactly. Yeah. You need to learn how to avoid that because, number one, you're not going to be heard otherwise, but it's almost like a pre-mixing thing. Don't just think of it as arranging, but think of it as I want this part to be able to be heard in the mix, so I need to make sure it happens when something else isn't going to obliterate it.
Well, I think it's important. But you just said something even before with rehearsals. Before I got into post-production, I was in music. And sometimes when I was doing music mixes, I was complimented for things that I thought was actually done on the composition side. Because a good arrangement, and when musicians think about what's happening at what time and how their instruments sound, I mean, that's a lot of it. A lot of it is capture.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it's making sure the people don't get in the way because they're actually listening. And that's one thing I loved before is the concept of capturing music rather than, say, manufacturing with every bell and whistle and everything you can throw in. And it's sometimes just that magic that you're able to get within those players.
Yeah.
The funny part, too, is if you listen to some of your favorite classic old records from the 70s or 80s, say, you listen to those and you realize the musicianship had to be much better than it has to be today because you had to just be capturing it. There are records from back then that were very simple recordings that you'd be hard-pressed to recreate today because back then it was all about the performances. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody is one of those that is often brought up that I don't remember how many tracks that was recorded on originally.
Four tracks.
No,
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no. That would have been a little too incredible.
It had to be
24 or less, though.
Yeah.
And, you know, to recreate that song the way people would do it today in Pro Tools or, you know, trying not to have to bounce vocals because people don't want to commit to anything in the recording process anymore, you'd be into hundreds of tracks to recreate that song and it wouldn't end up being as cool.
Well, yeah. I mean,
when you're forced to make decisions like what vocals to bounce, you know, the best people are going to make great decisions and great records are going to come out of it.
Well, I know some people that, you know, are demoing songs and just on their demo, they'll open up, you know, 56 to 72 tracks. And
you're like, well, because you can.
Exactly. Yeah.
But just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny, even in post-production, I had a wonderful opportunity to work on a film called American Beauty, and Scott Milan and Sam Mendes was the director. Scott Milan was the lead mixer. And what was great on that, it kind of reminds me of the equivalent of doing jazz in film in that our goal was to figure out how much silence we could use. And it was all not by accident. It was all really picking our moments. Tom Newman's score was amazing. And really finding those key areas to be the most effective in. So we kind of did a mix on negative space and built that soundtrack around a different concept. And it's great. I mean, sometimes instead of going full tilt boogie, it's great to sit back as like it reminds me of the equivalent of watching great musicians picking their moments of where they want to play and not having to show every lick and every piece of technical know-how they know how to use.
Well, it's the great – that's the John Cage piece. Is it 213? What's the 413? I can't – so I'm spacing on the name of it. But it's the one where the pianist sits at the piano for a prescribed period of time and does not play. And that's the piece. And people are like, oh, John Cage, you know, the jokester, whatever. But apparently, and I read this, and it could be wrong, he wrote the piece because it was being debuted in some theater, some concert hall, which was actually open at one end, and it was in the woods. It's like, you know, summer stock or something like that. So the pianist goes up there, and everyone's very, very quiet and sitting in the audience. And the first 30 seconds go by, and everyone's saying, oh, what a jackass, you know, John Cage. But about 40 seconds in, people actually start listening to what's going around them, and they hear their chairs creaking, and they hear some birds out in the woods. And by the time this time was up, everybody was incredibly aware of everything else going on around them. And it's a really powerful thing to do, and it's powerful to do in an arrangement, to break something down, to do anything, but just to make yourself really aware of what's there as opposed to just throwing a ton of stuff at it.
Well, which goes back to on, you know, Stadium Arcadia, where you have the guitar coming out of one speaker, and it's not only is it the guitar coming out of the right side, but it's the fact that there's nothing coming on the left side. You know, it's this kind of yin-yang kind of, you know, makes itself you hear the dead space kind of opens up these little holes for things to come in. And
then it makes it really special when all of a sudden the other guitar comes in, as opposed to being in the middle and then, you know, it would still do something, but it's not as big.
I've heard – what is your saying about silence, Scott?
Oh, yeah. No, I always say that the loudest sound that I've got is silence. The loudest sound I could produce is silence.
I remember seeing American Beauty first time when you took me to a screening, and there were a few spots where there's just
absolutely
dead silence,
nothing,
and
no.
It's just deafening.
Oh, yeah, Annette Bening, after she kind of freaks out, and she's wiping her face, and she's in front of the Acadia door, and we just paused it. There's no sound, zero, zip, zero. There's no air tone. There's nothing.
Just all faders
that,
down.
We wanted that pause. We wanted that uncomfortable silence. And then it jumps into a basketball game. And it was great. And I have to admit that Sam, because of his theater experience, and it's the first movie ever made, took us on a journey and led us explore areas that I thought were pretty brave for a director to do, because to sit there and go with no sound and minimal music, you've really got to believe in what's happening on all aspects. And he just went there, and once we started unveiling all the stuff, we started finding new stuff that we'd have never seen before and heard, because it's always masked with so much sound. And it was just a wonderful journey. And really, it was leading to how quiet can we get it. And it was just really interesting using those tools.
You know, think about in a pop music mix or a dance music mix, one of the most refreshing, most fun things to do is to start breaking it down. You know, there's something incredibly pleasing about taking parts out once you have the mix built up. And that's actually a really valid thing to do in a mix. You know, a lot of times, especially, you know, in my case, if I'm writing the music and trying to do my own rough mix of it initially, I get stuck with needing to hear all the parts all the time. But the truth is, they don't all need to be there, and it's a really refreshing thing to do breakdowns and pull things out.
Well, speaking of...
I've left you speechless.
Yeah, I know.
See, that was silence. That was the loudest, sound on the arsenal.
I was going to go for the pause and then come in with a joke, but it was just like... I just missed it. Well, hey, getting back to mixing after we go off that nice little tangent.
No, we were still.
No, I know.
It was pretty mixish.
It was pretty mixish. One thing I wanted to ask you was, level-wise, this record didn't seem like it was just tearing itself apart, being just absolutely the hottest that it absolutely had to be. Where did you mix level-wise? What were you aiming for?
It's going to go against, you know, what you hear, which is probably a good thing, is for me, when I'm mixing on analog consoles, and it seems to hold true for all of them, SSLs, Neves, APIs, to me, the console doesn't sound right until I'm hammering the mix bus. Absolutely hammering it. I mean, to the point where on most mixes, the VU meters for the mix bus are music playing indicators. You start the mix, they go all the way up, and they hang out there until the very end. It's not necessarily technically the right way to do it. It's not as much headroom. I've got tons of headroom going into EQs and things like that, but the mix bus itself gets pretty well hammered. And then since all of the mixes were put onto half-inch tape, I mean, that at that point, well, you have to cal your machine so it can handle the level you're popping into it. Right. So that tends to bring it back down a little bit.
That speaks a lot of those analog consoles, because you absolutely can do that. You can hammer that.
But isn't it mostly, though, that you – it's because you like the sound that creates, not that it's necessarily loud. It's a sound that you like.
Oh, yeah.
The
I mean, you know, you can
changed.
Always turn the speakers up if you just want to hear it louder. Yeah, it's just the sound of it. It glues it together more when you start creaming it, because it does – I mean, not to the point of like distortion where you say, well, you're distorting the mix bus, but there is some more harmonic distortion and some more compression, because there are transformers which compress when they get lots of level.
Yeah, don't attempt this in Pro Tools.
Yeah, I mean, Pro Tools, it's really simple. You get too loud and it sounds like crap, and there you go. And when you're below that, it sounds fine. So, no, it's definitely an analog console thing to do.
When you do work in Pro Tools or some of the digital formats, how much headroom do you usually try to allow for?
Well, none, really. I mean, I don't worry about leaving room. Because if you're mixing digitally, the only time where the traditional sense of headroom comes into play is in the converters. And obviously you don't want to cream your D to A's, because any analog circuit, as you get closer to the maximum it can go with, it's going to be slower, it's going to start distorting, which may or may not be a good thing. Neve mix bus, that's a good thing.
Right.
Pro Tools converters or anybody's D to A is not necessarily a good thing. The analog circuit is what starts to break down, really. But if you're below clipping, you're below clipping, and the stuff comes out. I mean, I don't really have a problem hammering the bus in Pro Tools either. You know?
No, I work the same way. I keep it as hot as I can get it without going over.
Yeah, I mean, there are times when I'll be recording something digitally into Pro Tools, and I'll realize, you know what, it's starting to sound a little something or other, even though I'm not seeing clipping.
Right.
I feel like, well, I'm probably pushing the analog front end of this too hard. But once it's digital... it's digital, and you can always turn it down. And, you know, there's a theory, oh, use all the bits. But you don't do that either, because then you're probably going to compress it to the point so that the meter stays up all the time. And at that point, you've lost all your analog headroom as well as your digital.
Right.
But I don't worry too much about it.
Is there a place that you like to put the vocals in? In other words, is there a level that you like to stick the vocals approximately at a certain digital dB?
It's never that scientific. And I mean, I use the meters when I record just like you would on a tape machine. You know, I just like, if I have VU meters, I like it to sit around zero. And if I've got peak meters, I make sure I'm not clipping, but that I'm not down in the dirt.
I will give one another beginner point, like when you're tracking vocals and things like that in Pro Tools. Just know that singers will always, their voices will open up as they sing. They'll get more emotional as they get more and more used to a song or a commercial or whatever they're singing. And so it's a really good idea to make sure, you know, you don't want everything up at zero. Make sure you leave some room, especially on a vocal track, because the problem that can happen, and I've seen it happen in so many sessions using Pro Tools or Nuendo or any kind of disc recorder, is levels will get set, a band will be performing or a singer will be singing or whatever, and people stop paying attention. And they figure, well, it's the same people we had at the beginning of the tracking session as we have now.
It's a clip fest.
Yeah, and it becomes a clip fest, and then later it ends up being a real problem. And the truth is, you're not going to hear the difference, especially in 24-bit recording, if you cut everything a few dBs quieter. It's a much better idea.
Also, when you're using analog gear for the front end, I mean, usually that, I mean, to be technical about it for a second, zero VU is plus 4 dBU. Mm-hmm. And people align their digital systems with maybe 18 dB of headroom above that, 20 dB of headroom above that. But the analog gear is not necessarily expecting to go 18 dB above zero.
Right.
So you run all your analog stuff at the levels it expects to be, and when you go into your digital gear, most likely it's going to be a pretty good level. Mm-hmm. It's going to be fine.
Do you find you do minus 20s plus 4? Do you do minus 18, minus 16?
Minus 18 usually, just because it's what I've always done. There have been a couple of projects. It depends. If you're working with analog, if you're using Studers and you align at minus 18, you can just transfer straight across. You can just plug them straight in, and Studers have built-in compression in the tape heads and also on the tape. It's really, really hard to clip the input of Pro Tools coming out of a Studer. The machines at Oceanway, these Ampex, old Ampex washing machine 350s, not 350s, they are, I forget the model number. But anyway, right, the really huge Ampex 2-inch machines have more headroom than that, and you actually have to go down to minus 15 to be able to have enough room on the input side to get the tapes transferred in properly. So, but generally minus 18 is where I sit.
Wow, that was a lot of information.
Yeah, with a really bad model number snafu there.
No, that was great. Well, hey, we're gonna be wrapping things up, but I just wanted to thank you, Andrew, for joining us today, and it was
Thanks
really
for having
great. Me. And if you guys haven't picked up Stadium Arcadium, you need to pick it up because it's a really good album, not only just because of the songs, but also studying what you guys did, because both of you guys did a great job mixing the album.
Well, thank you very much.
That's about it. You guys have any closing comments?
Ampex ATR-124.
Ah, yeah.
There you go.
I was just going to put some stunning silence there.
Sorry, I blew it.
Oh, and I realized one other thing from today. We got to figure out a way to get Scott Gershon a gig on the road with Stevie.
Yeah. Well, he did hit me up from sound effects.
Yeah, he did hit you for sound effects.
That's right. Yeah.
I just do it all live, you know.
You ready to go out on the road?
There we go.
Maybe not.
So that's it. Until next time, this is Mike saying goodbye. Rob, you want to say goodbye?
Are we all saying goodbye?
Let's all say goodbye.
One, two, three.
Goodbye.
Good night, Chris.
See you next time.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio.